Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
We did research. We did focus groups with top women, with our GMs. And what we found from the women was that when they played and competed at the highest levels, all of our players wear headsets. I mean, if you're going to play at an elite level, you have to have a headset and communicate with your teammates. And what happened was, as soon as they kind of identified as a woman with a woman's voice, they got passed the ball less. You know, they were harassed at times. It was a kind of a toxic environment for them. And so they were getting passed the ball less often than other their male counterparts. And so as a result, if we're evaluating statistics, of course their statistics are going to be less. If they're not getting as many opportunities. And so so we then in season two, you know, we worked with our analytics company to start analyzing players, how effective they were when they actually got the ball.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Doing creative work can be kind of lonely, and that's why we built the Unmistakable Listener Tribe. The Tribe is a community for professionals to connect and support each other. Everything is designed to help you grow your business and share what's working and what isn't. And that's true whether you're a business owner or an artist. You'll get access to feedback, live conversations with guests, and so much more. By joining the Tribe, you become part of a community of creators who all support each other, and it's completely free. Hopefully I'll see you there. Visit unmistakablecreative.com/tribe to join. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/tribe. Brennan, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Of course, Srini. Great to meet you, and I'm excited to chat.
I am absolutely thrilled to have you here. So I actually found out about you by way of our former guest, Scott, who was the CEO of the Philadelphia 76ers. And when he told me that you're the commissioner of the NBA 2K League, I thought, yes, I absolutely have to talk to him. I play this damn game every single day, and my roommate is kicking my ass, so maybe you can help me solve that problem. But all joking aside, before we get into what you do, I want to start by asking, what did your parents do for work, and how did that end up shaping the choices that you've made throughout your life and your career?
Wow, great question. So two very different paths. So my father was the CFO of a hospital at a very young age. I think in his late 20s, he was the CFO of a hospital in Long Island, New York. And I can remember him taking me to work sometimes, and I was always blown away at just how he just knew everybody. I mean, from, you know, walking in the back entrance, he knew the maintenance staff, he knew the CEO, he just knew everybody, and he was just friendly with everyone. And that always stuck out to me as a pretty cool trait. So that was my dad, and he, I'll get into kind of, I'll connect the dots between him and my mom in a second, but my mom, so I am the youngest of six kids, I grew up in Long Island, like I said, and my mom actually was a nurse, went to nursing school, and then essentially when she had my oldest brother, stopped. And she was a mom for, roughly 16 years. She was focused on raising her family and being a mom. and an incredible one, like, you know, with homework and everything else, she was always kind of super, super attentive. And then when I went to kindergarten, she actually went back to being a nurse and doing, you know, working for a home care agency as a nurse. And then, you know, she was putting in so many hours. When I was a freshman, sophomore in high school. So, you know, fast forward, that's about 10 years or so from when she started going back to work. Her and my sisters, you know, decided, like, listen, why don't you start your own home care agency? And so my mom did just that. And my dad actually helped her. He, you know, he was at a different hospital in Connecticut. Unfortunately, you know, his job didn't work out. And so he ended up becoming the CFO of my mom's home care agency. And so, I mean, talk about a remarkable, like, you know, I'm obviously my dad was an incredible executive, and my mom, you know, to watch her go from, you know, totally like committed to being a mom and raising kids, six kids at that. And then, and then starting your own business and being an incredibly successful executive. And I will say, like, a really good business leader for someone who had very little practical business experience. But, you know, just seeing her build relationships and, you know, and just hustle and lead by example, you know, and I will say being an incredibly strong example of a woman in business, I will say, I mean, it was a pretty powerful kind of foundation I was given.
Yeah. Wow. So I have to ask about, you know, six kids. What did growing up in such a big family teach you about navigating relationships, human behavior, and out of morbid curiosity, what's the age gap and which sibling are you closest to and why?
Yeah. So there's 11 years between the oldest and youngest. We're the Brady Bunch. So there's three boys and three girls. I'm the youngest. I guess I'm Bobby. So as far as closeness, I think I'm probably closest to my second oldest brother. We were kind of similar in terms of, you know, our competitiveness and just, you know, our drive probably. Your other question was about just kind of interacting in relationships.
I mean, a family of six is massive. I mean, I only have one sibling, so I always wonder this about people who have huge families.
Well, massive family, but like I would say, like tight quarters. I mean, you know, we were, you know, we had all the kids shared one bathroom, and you know, there was all the boys were in one bedroom, and my three sisters shared two other bedrooms, so it was tight. I slept in one of those, like, you know, beds that had a pull out drawer that I slept in. You know, I think the biggest thing I learned, and this is something I almost had to unlearn, was how we communicated. Like, you know, in that big of a family, communication was so passionate and like interactive. And like, if you didn't lean in, you weren't heard. And so, you know, really kind of like, you know, we would also just the way we were set up kind of family wise and how we interacted and communicated with each other, we would have just brawls and like, you know, and we'd be very argumentative and passionate. But then like, you know, it melted away. The second you were done with it, it was over and you were back to being family. And so I actually probably had to adjust a little bit in how I communicated to people who might've grown up in normal households that didn't have that, where, you know, I could, you know, get after it and like, you know, banter with somebody. And then just like 2 seconds later, I was fine. Like I didn't mind if they had kind of come at me a little bit hard. But I, you know, in normal society, I guess I had to make that adjustment.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, it's funny. You mentioned your mother going from being a mother of six kids to, you know, starting a business to becoming an executive. And there's this quote that immediately came to my mind when you said that. Have you ever seen the TV show Brothers and Sisters with Sally Field?
No. And I'm an avid content consumer. So no, I'm bummed.
Okay, so there's this quote where she, you know, not to ruin it for anybody, but you know, she ends up, you know, losing her husband at the very beginning of the series. And she goes in to pitch some investors on a business idea for some sort of center that she wants to open. And, you know, they basically question her lack of experience. And so she goes out to dinner with one of the investors who only agrees to meet her because of her ex, you know, her husband who had passed away, who had built this very successful business. And he basically questions her experience. And in response, she says, I organized the schedules of five extremely well-rounded children. I ran carpools, bake sales, and bluebird groups. I negotiated, coddled, and mandated all at the same time, not to mention what I had to do for my husband to keep him happy and productive. And I did all of this without taking a sick day. The problem is no one values the experience of a stay-at-home parent, which is truly a shame, because running this big enterprise, as you put it, would be a day at the beach for me. And so I love that. That is probably my favorite moment in the show. And what I wanted to ask you is, what does it take for somebody to build that within themselves, that level of sort of conviction and resourcefulness?
I think my guess is that, you know, my parents came from, I would argue, what is one of the coolest generations of parents, you know, in one of the coolest ones in history, in terms of, you know, for them, all of my grandparents came over from Ireland, you know, kind of came to the US and really started their lives and like didn't have much to work with, and they just made it happen. And so I think that generation, at least for me, you know, I don't know, and there's obviously been books written about that generation, but I think they all installed this sense of, you know, just get it done. I don't want to hear your excuses. And so I think, you know, my mom had that installed in her by her parents and just seeing them operate. And so I think that was a big piece of it. And listen, I don't know what it, you know, when or how it was installed in her, but she just had this, you know, she had an incredible work ethic. You know, I guess, to use a sports analogy, both on and off the court. I mean, she was, she went 100% plus at work, but then also she didn't come home and like, you know, complain, oh, I worked all day. Like, you know, you got to take care of this. She was at all my basketball games. You know, she was always present. She was, you know, pushing me to work hard on my studies. You know, it was, and my dad did too. My dad was also, you know, and I would say like probably to his credit, he was a probably more balanced executive than I might be now, in terms of like he left the office at 5 o'clock and he was home and we would be playing catch or, you know, or playing basketball together. And he really did a good job of being present as a dad while also being an executive.
Wow. So you mentioned playing basketball. It's funny because I've mentioned this on the show before. I played basketball for 2 seasons in 7th and 8th grade. In 7th grade, I was the most improved player, which just meant I was the shittiest player on the team, which is not apparently the case in the NBA. When somebody is the most improved player, they're like badass. I believe at one point Jimmy Butler was. But what I'm curious about is what piqued your interest in sports, and how old were you when you started playing basketball?
Oh, I was a sports nut from the very beginning. And that's where I had two older brothers and my dad that were all sports nuts. And we were going to Mets, Islanders, Knicks. You know, it was a year round obsession. It was just whatever season it was. That's what sport we were following. So yeah, early on, I was a kind of traditional football in the fall, basketball in the winter, baseball in the spring from, you know, through 8th grade. And then I just got focused on basketball because it was probably the one I was best at. So yeah, I was obsessed with it. And I was like, you know, my family makes fun of me. Like I was like an 80-year-old man when I would wake up in the morning and I'd walk out in the driveway, get the newspaper, you know, Daily News, or whatever, you know, we were getting delivered. And I read the sports section cover to cover while eating my cereal. Like that was what I did from like, and literally probably from like 6 or 7. Like it was bizarre. Wow. And I mean, again, to make myself sound like a nerd, like I would read like the sports almanac. And like, I was always obsessed with statistics and just the history of sports. So it was all, my intellectual curiosity pushed me in that direction, but I was always super engaged with sports.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah. Well, so as somebody who didn't continue playing sports in high school, which to this day, I think is one of my regrets, because I feel like every single person I've ever talked to who was a athlete on a team in high school swears by the benefits of it, regardless of whether it led anywhere or not. For parents who are listening, and particularly for parents who are stuck with kids like me who are athletically inept, what would you say to them about encouraging their kids to play sports?
Well, okay. So I'll say this, as a person now who oversees an esports league, I would say I would encourage them to compete. Cause I can tell you, somewhat more personal to me is, I have a son with special needs. And so he wasn't able to compete on the athletic field for quite a while. And now he does now swim for his high school. And it was the first time he'd ever been on a sports team. And so it definitely, I love watching him be a part of a team, and it's incredible. And so, for him and I, our equivalent of like my dad taking me to see a Mets game and sit there and talk about like what was going on at life and school and having that kind of uninterrupted time together. Our equivalent was when he turned five, I think it was five, and he's now 15, to put it in perspective. When he turned five, my wife got us gaming chairs. And so if you came to our house on a weekend, you would see us playing games in many cases together, kind of playing a game at the same time, or playing 2K, or playing one of his kind of more action games we play together. And to this day, we still play 2K, and oftentimes at night we'll play Fortnite together. So it's for us, that was our equivalent. And he learned competing, I think, a lot through gaming, actually. And so, I do think, gaming is a great equalizer for you know, if you don't necessarily have all the physical tools to compete on an athletic field, you know, your whole life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I want to go deeper into that because I think that we have sort of two narratives around video games, right? It's kind of like, oh, video games make kids lazy and inept. And, you know, you hear things like, oh, Grand Theft Auto causes violence, which I personally don't believe any of that to be true. But I, of course, am biased because I've been playing video games, I think, as far as I can remember, from the original Nintendo, which I'm curious about. How old were you when you started playing video games?
I was an Atari kid. So, okay. I would say probably first grade, and my oldest brother, that was where he and I were super tight that way. Like, we were the two gamers in the house. My middle brother didn't play video games at all. He never got into it, but that was our thing. And so, yeah, I was an early adopter to video games.
Yeah. Well, so I think that one of the things I wonder, yeah, and I've asked a couple of different people this, we had this guy, Jeff Harry, here, who talked about the importance of play. And you as the commissioner of the 2K League, obviously, clearly, probably think there are positive benefits to video games. So what are they? I mean, because you've probably been able to see this over a long stretch of time and have a bigger sample size than the average person.
Well, I think if you asked me this question and in my mindset, you know, when I first started playing video games, what, 1980 or so, it's just so different now because... I mean, your video game experience now compared to when I started playing video games. When I started playing video games, you were in your room, you were by yourself, you were playing against AI, you know, to where fast forward to now, it's very communal. I mean, you know, when my son's playing, you know, if we're playing Fortnite, like, for a great example is, so we play Fortnite at times, like, he and I will play, and my college roommate and his son, we will team up at nighttime after we eat dinner. And like, we'll play squads. We'll be the four of us against, you know, 24 other teams playing, you know, against us and competing against us in Fortnite. Like, it's actually a pretty cool connectivity piece. I mean, I think, you know, if in the wrong hands, you know, unwatched, sure, you can go down, you know, you can get too into it and you need some balance. And we definitely encourage that. And listen, my son is super active. He works out, he swims, you know, he's very active. And so we try to limit the number of hours he's playing games. But I mean, I actually think it's a very, it has a sense of community much more so than gaming did when we were growing up.
Yeah. I mean, I live with the roommate I live with now because of NBA 2K.
That's like, so great.
It's kind of hilarious that's how we ended up living together. But well, let's talk about the trajectory of your career. So where I want to start is, you know, with six siblings, I always wonder how the career advice that you get from your parents differs from sibling to sibling, because I feel like basically every person that comes before you is an experiment, and then the parent fixes the mistakes they make on the previous one on the next one.
Yeah, it's a great point. And so going back to my generational, you know, kind of theory earlier, I do think that my parents were much more in the camp of, you're smart enough, go be a lawyer, like, go get a good job and so you can provide for your family and put your kids through school. And so that was their mindset. And so I do think that I've spent a lot of my years, you know, as I was starting my career and going through college and then early in my career, really breaking the mold of what they thought was possible and really what they thought was normal. And so, you know, I think I did, I was just always very independent by nature. And so I was determined to make, you know, my career something I was passionate about and following my heart, which was, I wanted to be in sports. I wanted to be connected to sports in some way. And so, you know, when I was in high school, you know, I mentioned my obsession with sports and consuming sports media. And I lived in New York at a time when sports radio became a huge medium. And I was listening to Mike and the Mad Dog and that kind of, you know, WFAN in New York. And that, you know, at that point was more of a local station. And so my total dream going at sports was I wanted to be on sports radio. And I wanted to be, you know, and that was my goal. It was my dream. And that was my first job in sports. Was outside of, like, you know, writings for you know, yearbooks and local papers on sports. But when I was in college, I did an internship for sports radio WEEI in Boston. which was the sports, it was the equivalent of WFAN in Boston. And so I got a job, you know, I begged my way into that job. A guy I knew at Boston College was working there on the production side. And I basically told him, whatever I need to do, I will work for free. Just get me in. And so my junior and senior year of college, I got a job with them. And I will tell you, probably one of the worst jobs in sports was my job was to screen the calls coming in. So I would answer incoming calls. I would kind of find out what somebody wanted to talk about. And then I would send them on to talk to the host. And it was the worst job. You had like a sentence of like, hey, I want to talk about, you know, Barry Bonds. And then you sent that person through and then they'd get nervous. They'd start stuttering. And then the host would get mad at you for putting them through. So it was a very, very tough job. But that's what led me into sports though.
Wow. So, I mean, like I was just looking at your LinkedIn profile. I mean, you have this sort of, you know, interesting trajectory of, you know, being in charge of ticket sales, going all the way to team operations. So numerous things. So first thing, one, what are the lessons that you have taken from, you know, working in the actual NBA that you've applied to 2K? And how is it that a video game has had this much of an impact on our culture? And then I want to talk about specifically esports, like what actually goes into building an esports team and how, you know, you actually run a league. Like how does it differ from being, for example, David Stern or Adam Silver, like your job?
Sure. So, I mean, the 2K league offices are essentially inside the NBA office. So it's still very much a part of the NBA. But what I think, and to his credit, what Adam Silver encouraged me to do was to be nimble, to act like a startup. And so I think, you know, even though we are inside the kind of the mothership of the NBA and we have a ton of influence and a ton of resources from the NBA, I think, you know, what was important for us and for me to make sure I did early on was I had to make sure we were very operational and we were very kind of like nimble and quick to make adjustments and much more nimble and risky, frankly, than the NBA could ever be.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was a really early on. I knew we had to be that way because just to be functional, you know, we only had 8 people running the entire operation the first season. Yeah. So it was a small operation. And now we're, you know, more than double that size, but so that's on the NBA side. As far as what I've learned, I think just learning the value of leadership, and then the value, and because we're a smaller group, the importance of instilling confidence in your team and letting, you know, removing obstacles, letting them do their thing and then getting out of their way. Because frankly, we had so much to do with such a small group that I never could have been effective if I was trying to hold everyone's hand.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah. So what does the actual business model of the 2K League look like? And you know, how does it compare? Because I'm guessing, you know, unlike sort of, you know, the traditional NBA, it's not, you know, a bunch of college students being recruited to play college ball and then being drafted to the NBA, right? So what does the business model look like? Like, how do you guys make money?
So that is not too dissimilar from the traditional sports model. So it's media rights, it's sponsorship, it's retail, merchandise, and then eventually it'll be more ticket sales. I mean, we were kind of steering in that direction last season, but unfortunately COVID didn't allow for it. So, but ticket sales is definitely a possible revenue stream. So on the business side, it's actually not too dissimilar from kind of the NBA and its affiliate leagues. Where it's tricky is we at the center, we do essentially the recruiting and the player identification for the teams. And so, for example, you know, the first season, we opened up tryouts and we had 72,000 people try out.
Holy crap.
Yeah. I mean, so you had 72,000 people trying out for 102 spots. And so, to their credit, 2K developed what we call the Combine, which was a kind of standalone mode in the game. Allowed players to go in and play 5-on-5, and so and kept everybody on an even playing field. Like you mentioned, like trying to build teams and make it fair. We actually have, you know, where every player was a 90 rated player, and you know they could go in and compete against, you know, other 72,000 people. And so as far as our resources being limited, what we did was we hired a third party company to essentially build an algorithm that would evaluate players. And we were evaluating, you know, 60 different plus stats across every single player in every single game. Wow. I mean, literally millions of data points. And so things down, I mean, and it was much, much deeper than points, rebounds, and assists. I mean, we were evaluating, you know, telemetry data and, you know, how good was, you know, how perfect is their jump shot? How good is their release point versus perfect, their defensive efficiency, their offensive efficiency, like, you know, how often did they go for a steal and put themselves out of position? Like, it's a pretty amazing amount of data we're capturing and still capturing. And so all of that kind of rolled into, you know, we identified about 250 players and then narrowed that down to 102 on draft day. And so our first season, we actually declared the 102 players and the teams drafted them. Now we've evolved our system every year. This past season we had, I think, I believe it was 285 players that were eligible for the draft to be drafted. And we had roughly, I think, about 60 some odd spots that were drafted on top of the current players who were on rosters. So to the player identification point, we've also added other elements to our player ID process, such as, we now have tryouts in London. We've had a tryout in Hong Kong, in Seoul, Korea. So we've gone and done tryouts in other countries to identify players around the world. Because, if you're in Australia, trying to compete against North American players, your connection is a huge disadvantage.
Mm.
So we had to find great players and actually invite them, to tryouts, physically or remotely in different regions. So that we were able to identify great players around the world. And so the end result is now we have 10 international players on our team rosters. Including this year, we had our first from Spain, our first from Australia. So we were identifying international players. And the other player diversity piece, which is a really interesting story, is on with getting women in the game and finding women. Because what was amazing was our first season, we had the 72,000 players try out. We got down to the final 250, and we only had one woman. And that woman, unfortunately, did not go from the 250 down to the 102. She was eliminated in that process. But we immediately said, okay, well, why is that? There's no reason why a woman can't compete in 2K. Why would we not have any women in the league? And so we immediately began our Women in Gaming initiative. And so we did research, we did focus groups with top women, with our GMs. And what we found from the women was that when they played and competed at the highest levels, all of our players wear headsets. I mean, if you're going to play at an elite level, you have to have a headset and communicate with your teammates. And what happened was, as soon as they kind of identified as a woman with a woman's voice, they got passed the ball less. Wow. They were harassed at times. It was a kind of a toxic environment for them. And so they were getting passed the ball less often than their male counterparts. And so as a result, if we're evaluating statistics, of course, their statistics are going to be less if they're not getting as many opportunities. And so so we then in season two, we worked with our analytics company to start analyzing players, how effective they were when they actually got the ball. And so it totally changed the dynamic of our analysis. We ended up with a couple women in our draft pool. We had our first woman actually drafted by the Golden State Warriors and Warriors Gaming Squad. And so we kind of broke that barrier in season two, but our work was far from done. Like, we still had a lot of work to do. And so in season three, we had four women in the draft pool and none of them got drafted. And so that immediately was like, okay, there's something broken here. Like, we're not doing something right. We're not good enough. And so this past off season, our women in gaming initiative, what we found out from GMs and coaches was they weren't playing against the top level players. There wasn't enough of enough information or examples of seeing them compete against the top players in the world. So we actually, our Women in Gaming initiative became a much more robust process. We actually went out and we helped identify and helped create two top women pro-am teams. So two 5-on-5 teams that they entered into the top tournaments. They were competing at the highest levels. We did that. And then secondarily, we set up these remote gameplay sessions where we had, the known best women players in the 2K scene competing with some of our top 2K league pros. Coaches and GMs came in and watched. We had a couple of former 2K league players, pros, coaching the teams. And so that was kind of the second step. And then the third step, which we've now done two of them, two consecutive years, is we created a women in gaming development camp where we had the top 20 women players that were known in the 2K league scene. We had, WNBA players come talk to them. We had top top esports pros, top influencers, kind of talk to them about how to navigate, you know, social media and streaming. And then we had them gameplay a ton against each other and also with 2K League pros. And so all of those kind of steps now this past year, you know, we had a, you know, we had, I believe it was 9 or 10, I think it was 10 women we had in the draft pool, and we had 2 women drafted this year. And so now we have 2 women currently in the league. And so as I will say, like, we still have plenty of work to do and we're not checking the box by any stretch of the imagination. But what our goal is really is to just, one, get the best players in the world. And we think a diverse pool is just a stronger pool. But then number two is we're trying to normalize women in the 2K League scene. And so, you know, certainly we want women players, but if you watch our broadcast, we have several women on our broadcast team. You know, if you look at our executive team, you know, some of our top executives of the league are women. And so we're just trying to normalize women in the 2K League scene more broadly. And I think we have taken significant steps in the right direction, but we still have a lot of work to do.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I wanted to ask you about sort of the skill development aspect of this, because, you know, my roommate, when he gets on these winning streaks, jokingly, you know, declares himself as the NBA god. And I was like, yeah, you want to see how good you are? Go play a teenager online. Then we'll find out how good you really are. But, you know, I remember talking to a friend of mine, and as I was joking with you before we hit record, that, you know, if I ever had a few money, the first thing I would do was buy an NBA basketball team. And one of my friends said, you could potentially buy an esports team. He said that's probably more realistic and probably where we're headed next anyways. So for the esports athletes, like, what goes into, you know, their own skill development? Because I doubt it's sort of the way that my roommate and I play. My guess is they're probably very they probably have what, you know, Anders Ericsson would have called deliberate practice. Like, they're probably doing things to improve.
Totally. And I will say, I mean, that's kind of also that, you know, one is they just play a lot. They do have a unique skill set. They generally speaking have an incredibly high basketball IQ, and so they begin to compete at the highest levels. And you know, and you know how it is. I mean, first you start by being the best player, you know, on your block, then your school, then your area. Like, you just start competing more and more at higher levels, and so that scene kind of organically happens also. But I will say, as far as esports goes, I think we're at the early stages of what the right training is for an esports athlete, because I actually think it's, and we're starting to see it more developed, but I think this notion of, like, just put in the hours and become a master and, like, just grind and grind and grind, and that's what's going to make you great. I think that's old school. I mean, it's kind of an archaic perspective. Like, I mean, you have to think that, you know, we encourage our players, like, they work, many of them work out together and physically fit, you know, their nutrition is a consideration. Certainly your eyesight and your hands are, you know, are as important as anything. Like, you know, it's the equivalent of, like, jumping ability and speed for, you know, an NBA player. So I think we're at the early stages, of really what truly good professional skill development is in esports. And I will say, it's interesting, is so the only non-NBA owned team in our league are, you know, so we sold our first franchise outside of the NBA family last year to the Genji Tigers of Shanghai. And Genji, wow. Genji has, you know, and this number has probably changed now, but at the time they had, you know, they had 11 different esports teams across 7 different games. And what they were, and one of the reasons we actually decided to partner with them and actually have them buy a franchise is they were, you know, somewhat tip of the spear in terms of player development in esports. And so they actually run an esports school in Seoul, Korea. And it's truly a remarkable facility. I've been there, you know, and they are developing kind of a balanced attack to, you know, they have education, they have, you know, obviously esports development. And so we thought they brought a really unique kind of skill set to the NBA 2K League. And so and one of the things they actually are helping us do is identify 2K players in China to kind of help bring the league and continue to grow the league.
Yeah. So there are a couple of things I wonder about sort of somebody who's got a potentially promising career in esports. So I remember very distinctly, we were stuck at the Dallas airport for 3 or 4 hours after we were teaching a seminar, but my roommate and I, and we just happened to walk by this section. I was like, wait a minute, they have a whole video game section here? And we walk up to the guy, we're like, do you guys have NBA 2K? We have 3 hours. And he's like, yeah, of course we have 2K. So we literally paid $40 to play a game that like we had at home for a couple of hours. But he had started telling us about the fact that now esports is leading to people getting college scholarships, you know, and all sorts of things. So there are two questions I have about this. And typically, like when you look at a lot of the NBA athletes, or you know, for that matter, many of the professional sports like the NFL, a lot of these people come from fairly underprivileged backgrounds, right? Tough neighborhoods, poor families. And that is often the path out of poverty for so many of them. But when you're talking about something like esports, an Xbox is not a cheap purchase for the average person. You know, a copy of 2K at this point is about $100. I only know this because I remember thinking, I was like, you know, the target market for video games is not really kids, it's people my age, because for us, $100 is not a big deal. Like, we have the disposable income to spend on video games. So what role do you think that privilege plays in the prospects of all these people?
I don't know. I don't think many of our pros come from very challenging, you know, upbringings, and in many cases, very kind of, very, like, I would say very tough backgrounds in terms of like where they grew up and what they had access to. And I think, I think, you know, 2K, you know, you're right. A console, you know, is not inexpensive, but I do think a lot of players, you know, maybe share them early on as kids. I think 2K does a pretty good job of, you know, making, you know, even last year, I think, you know, they had the game available for a much lower cost, kind of in the latter part of the NBA season. I think it's, you know, you have to be creative to kind of try to find the right deal, I guess. But I will say, like, we do not see privilege being an advantage, at least our league makeup. That's not been the case.
Okay, cool. So out of morbid curiosity, this is for my own personal reasons. Can you give me any suggestions on how to put an end to this like 15 game losing streak that I've been on?
What's the breakdown? I mean, are you giving up too many threes? Are you breaking down on defense, not getting boards?
I think I would probably say I'm not passing enough and I'm probably shooting way too many threes.
Yeah, right. Well, listen, that sounds like a problem. I mean, you may have to get into the, get a little practice in on your three ball, or maybe change the sliders when he's not looking. So, you know, they're easier to make.
Yeah. So, I mean, you mentioned that you had sold a team. I mean, so this is, you know, back to that idea, like, is, you know, for somebody who's aspiring to own a sports team, as crazy as that might sound, because most of us are not, you know, Mark Cuban, you know, with enough money to buy the Mavericks, are esports teams going to be something that we start to see over and over? And like, what is happening on sort of the, you know, college recruiting path? Like, do you guys recruit from college, and what's happening in terms of opportunities that are being created outside of just playing the game? What kinds of opportunities has this created for people who play?
So kind of a little bit similar to my point on player development. I still think esports, it's such early days that everyone's trying to figure out what their place is in esports. And so I think it's going to continue to become a more prominent recruiting tool for colleges. I think, you know, you're already starting to see it, but seeing, you know, kind of college programs develop as, you know, as kind of a tool to recruit students. Cause I will say, I mean, like, the generally speaking, you know, esports enthusiasts are very tech savvy. They're very, you know, they generally are high IQ. So it's actually an interesting audience for colleges to get in front of. And so I think you're going to continue to see that develop. And then, and I even say we're trying to figure this out right now is, it, you know, we're trying to put a little more structure around just the grassroots competitive scene, because in order for us to be successful, it's not enough for us to have the top 138 players in the world. You know, we have to continue to develop that next part of the, and the, frankly, the wider part of the funnel, which is the, you know, over 2 million players that are literally playing the game, like yourself, probably 2 million players playing every day that are super competitive, but maybe they're not good enough to be in that 138. But as we grow, like, we want to make sure, like, that is a big part of our audience. And so we want to make that group feel connected to the 2K League and have a reason to watch it. And so that's that's really a big area of focus for us, is trying to figure out, you know, just how do we appeal to that next tier of competitive of the competitive scene. And so I think your point on colleges, I think we're seeing high schools also now.
I was going to ask you about that. That was my next question, is this starting to make its way into primary education?
It definitely is. And I think some of it is also trying to figure out what's the right entry point for a school. And I will say, like, 2K, we're very lucky in that, 2K is, it's rated E for everyone. It's not as controversial a choice as some other games might be, especially for a high school. So I do think you're going to see 2K's kind of grassroots community continue to grow as esports grows. And then the other really, I mean, I would call this a significant advantage is, because in 2K and the NBA 2K game is going to be the best basketball game in esports. And it's going to be for a long time, because, you know, obviously given the fact that it is the best game. And so as opposed to, you know, some of the other games out there, it's a very competitive marketplace. And to maintain your status as the game to play, you know, kudos to the games that are on top right now. But they always have kind of other, you know, game developers kind of, you know, creating what's next. I mean, you know, Fortnite really, you know, was kind of come on the scene the last, you know, couple of years. But it was a minute ago that PUBG was dominating that space. And then Fortnite came along and it's been incredibly successful at building an audience.
Wow. Well, so, you know, the thing that I had noticed, and I think I'd mentioned this to you, is that I've been playing this game for 20 years. And I couldn't believe that when I sat down and looked at it. I was like, wait a minute, I have played this game since 2K1. And my friend Ryan Holiday, whose work you might be familiar with, written a bunch of different books, all of which are New York Times bestsellers. He wrote this book called Perennial Seller, which is about how to make something that is timeless and something that lasts. And, you know, I know, like you said, when you think of, you know, a basketball video game, 2K is the first thing that anybody defaults to. What do you think it is that has led to that kind of dominance, the sort of perennial seller nature of 2K? And what do you think creative people can take away from that?
I would say for 2K, it's to their credit, is, like, you know, there's not many games that come out with an annual version of the game. And so, you know, most times there's a couple of years kind of, you know, of breathing room in between releases. And so, to their credit, I mean, the 2K development team, like, they have an insatiable appetite to continue to improve the game. And whether, you know, even the last couple of years, the way in which they added, you know, they added the neighborhood and the whole neighborhood experience, and, like, you know, and having different modes of the game to play. If you want to go play in the park, if you want to play team up, you want to play pro-am, like, there's so many different modes of the game to, you know, and it's the whole, I would say for marketers in general, it's the entire movement towards direct to consumer and really allowing the consumer to dictate their experience. And they want it to be customized. They want it to be personal. And I think 2K has done a brilliant job over the last several years of doing exactly that, of really customizing what the player wants. And so I think that's really been one of the, and I will say, like, it's one of the reasons why, like, it's not only a great selling game, it's also a game that has incredible engagement numbers. I mean, a lot of these players are playing 30 plus hours a week, and that doesn't happen unless you are creating something that's engaging enough.
Yeah, well, it's funny you say that, because I think I'd be horrified if I actually looked at how many hours we play every week. So, we have the three of us that live together, two of us play it, and our other roommate hates the fact that we play this game so damn much.
That's awesome. No, it's true. And then, the other point I was going to make, and I didn't touch on earlier, which you were kind of talking about, and I think I might have gone off on a different tangent, is you mentioned kind of, you know, the value of esports and how it's changing kind of the educational experience. The one biggest, I would say the biggest surprise I've had of the 2K League is that, listen, certainly we've identified the best 138 players in the world. They're incredible and you know, and they are amazing at what they do. But we've created, you know, probably at least that number, if not more, of jobs connected to the 2K League. And so whether you are, you know, what traditional sports calls announcers, we call casters. So if you're doing play-by-play or color commentary, you're doing sideline reporting, you know, we have an entire broadcast team. You know, we have content creators. We have, you know, media. There's obviously all the traditional jobs of sponsorship, sales, you know, marketing, you know, community development, etc. So I will say that, like, I think I find esports very exciting. For someone who's been in the sports industry for, you know, over two decades, what I find exciting about esports is that it's truly creating a whole new branch of the business that's creating a ton of jobs.
Yeah. Well, I before we hit record, you had told me that you had known Scott for 20 years, and the story of how you met was actually cool. So how did you guys meet?
Yeah, so my first, I was an intern for the Boston Celtics after I graduated Boston College. I interned for the Celtics, got a job in, and then they helped me get a job with the Detroit Pistons and Palace Sports. Soon after I graduated college, and so I was selling for the Pistons, and I was, you know, one of probably it was a massive sales organization, probably 60 sellers, and so Scott, he actually was in a group called Team Marketing and Business Operations, which is a kind of a McKinsey style, you know, consulting group for the NBA that David Stern started. And it was, you know, to help the teams with, you know, sharing best practices and being effective off the court. And so Scott was essentially the Pistons representative. So he would come into market and visit. And so I was just a generic seller. And so normally I would not get the opportunity. Generally, you know, someone like Scott would come in and he'd meet with all the senior executives. And so, for some, you know, he and I actually, you know, we played hoops in the morning. He would try to organize a basketball game when he came to town, and so we actually got to we competed against each other. We guarded each other, kind of playing hoops before the workday began. And then he agreed to give me a half hour and meet with me, and so that really started. Like, from that point, he kind of helped connect me. I took a job with the Milwaukee Bucks, and then eventually, you know, in New Orleans with then the Hornets, and then. I became very connected to that Teambo operation. And then ironically, I left the team side of the business after 12 years when I was with the Atlanta Hawks and Thrashers in Atlanta. I actually ironically took a job in Teambo in the NBA league office. You know, probably was 10 years after I met Scott.
Wow. Wow. I feel like I could talk to you about this for hours on end, but that's only because I'm obsessed with this game. Probably not as much as I doubt my listeners are as obsessed with it as I am. So I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
What's the last questions? You stumped me.
Yeah. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think it's legacy. I think it's the impact you have on the people around you. You know, and I hope that my team or people I've worked with and managed over the years. One thing, and frankly, I actually may have got this a little bit from Scott and learning from him and other mentors I've had over the years is I am very obsessed with talent and the development of talent. I will be very constructively critical of my team, but I think I get a lot of latitude with them because they know I care about them. I mean, I genuinely love my team and they know it. And so as a result, I think they know that, like, I'm coming from a good place and they can trust me, and they know that I'm just trying to help them get better and make a bigger impact and think bigger. And so I would say, like, you know, if you're not constructively helping your team grow, you're not giving them your best. And so I would say like that's a pretty big trait, I think, of leaders, you know, that I think they should make sure they stay true to themselves, but they make sure that they're helping their team get better.
Wow. Well, this has been amazing and fascinating and funny and insightful all at the same time. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your wisdom and insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything else that you're up to?
Obviously, our NBA2KLeague.com is our website, but I would say I am very active on Twitter. I am 2KLeagueMD. On Twitter. And so feel free to follow me there. And, I'll try to put some thought into maybe some nuggets of wisdom. I will say I now follow you. So I'm looking forward to seeing what else, I listened to Scott's interview. I want to listen to some of the others you've had on your podcast.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.